Blog Talk Radio.
The consummate good lover. That was Barry White. Hi, I'm Darlene Lewis, and you are once again on blogtalkradio.com on the Hear No Evil Hour. Tonight we're going to be on for 2 hours giving you nothing but good music, good topics, and we also have some surprise guests supposedly calling in. So I'm looking forward to that. You can call us now. We're live on the air at the radio station, 347-989-0761. 347-989-0761. And tonight's segment topic is, are you a good man? Now, so many women are complaining that they cannot find a good man. What makes you a good man? What qualities does a good man possess? And why are so many women alone? Call into the show right now so that we can talk about this. You know, a good man, some say, is someone who is considerate, caring, has a good sense of humor, knows himself, realizes that real men do cry on occasion, and is not ashamed of it. He is someone who knows what real strength comes from within and is not dependent upon his muscles or his physical size. He is not afraid to show affection to his wife, his lover, his children, grandchildren, animals, and friends. Now, if you feel that you meet some of those qualities, please call in, because a lot of people are under the impression that a good man is just someone that's a provider. Some men feel that, or some women feel, he does not get his sense of worth from the money in his bank account. Some say he knows what he does for a living is not who he is. He is secure enough in his masculinity, to put it nicely, pick up some feminine needs his wife, daughter, sister, mother may have during particular times of the month and not put up a fuss. Oh, yeah, some say he has to know how to clean, cook, do laundry, and will occasionally at least eat quiche. Now, that is what you call a real good domestic man. sometimes people say a good man is just somebody that just meets them at work, makes sure they have their food, their lunch money, their money to get home or to pay for the tolls, and someone who's there every night taking care of their physical and emotional needs. Some women are just satisfied with just having a man in the home, whether he works or not. If that's you, caller, that's great. Call us now, 347-989-0761. Here's a blast from the past with Earth, Wind, and Fire. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Darlene. This is Vincent Cook. I've been telling you for long if I was going to get on your show.
Hi, Vincent Cook. Wow, finally you got on. Thanks for calling in to Blog Talk Radio at Hear No Evil. How are you?
I'm just good. Everything is chill here in Tribeca.
Okay. Well, it was a really good day today. It was a good day to get a lot of things accomplished. Well, you know, tonight's topic, are you a good man? So many people are emailing me their opinions and of being a male. What do you consider a good man?
I think first and foremost, a good man is, if you're talking in terms of relationships, someone who is supportive, someone who doesn't live constantly with insecurities. If he is a father, he's a guy that will spend real time. Real time is not grudgingly taking your child to the store because your female partner is tired. No, real time is just taking control and wanting to be with your child. There's a difference. People get it twisted sometimes. I'm kind of old school, even though most people don't think so when they see me, but I also, excuse that, I also think part of the good man thing is a guy can do all. I mean, I cook. You know, I can clean. I hate cleaning, but I'd rather cook than clean, you know, do my laundry and all that other stuff. I mean, I really came into all of that because once my wife passed away some years back, and my son was 9 at that time. So after a little shock and, you know, depression, then I realized, wait a minute, I'm a single parent. I'm going to have to do this. And I've been doing it ever since. I mean, my son is 23 now. I can't tell him anything. But, you know, it's been a long ride. So to make a long story short, there's a lot of layers to being a good guy. And you notice none of what I said has to do with the whole thug madness, right?
Exactly.
There you go.
Now, you said that first of all, congratulations on surviving the depression of losing a loved one, and then being a single parent as a male, because you never ever get these type of stories on the air where the men are doing it and surviving and raising men. And which means that now your son had a role model to look for and look at, and now he knows what to do to take care of himself. And considering what we've been witnessing with the youth for the last 15, 20 years, to raise a son successfully without any problems is very rare. So my hat goes off to you. I salute you for that. Because that's
you.
A task in itself.
Yeah, it's
you know, a lot of these young guys don't even have men in their lives.
No, they don't. But I've talked to, and I'm trying to do some things where I can kind of work with some of the young people, because I've always gotten along with teens, you know, because
mm-hmm.
they, well, for whatever reason, they relate to me. They don't look at me as being an older guy,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I tell people all the time, I know single households with women that are run way better than two-parent households.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that it can't be done. I just don't think in certain instances, people put their best efforts in when they have that, you know, situation. The lazy factor comes in. And, you know, I know from once I became a single parent, you have to push yourself. And you know what? With me, I didn't have to think about anything. It just came to me what I had to do. Because when my wife was alive, you know, all of the modeling, the talent shows and the practice for my son, all that, she took him to all those things because she wanted to do that. The
mm-hmm.
The dentist appointments, the doctor's appointments. And then, you know, all of that changed. And I'm like, oh, snap. I got to do this stuff. And I did it.
Wow. how was your support system?
Oh, it was great because, you know, before she passed, my sister-in-law, her sister, she was a big help in terms of babysitting early on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then when he was old enough to go to preschool, he went to Fed Kids down here in Lower Manhattan. Actually, Fed Kids is inside the 26 Federal Plaza building.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, family on both sides of the family, relatives that we trust. So that was the easy part. Now, when she passed away, you know, there was a lot of family that was coming to me and asking me if I needed help. More than, you know what, I can't blame them because I was never put in that position before and they didn't really know how I was going to do. But then they saw that, no, I got this. I can do this.
Mm.
You know, it was, there was a lot of times that there were things that I wanted to do, but I couldn't do it because it's obvious it was me and him, and I did not want to, you know, always get comfortable with having him stay with his grandmother or something like that. So basically, you know, it's just a commitment. You got to be strong. And I can't believe that all these years have passed. It's just amazing. Time goes fast.
Yeah. Now, how was your dating life like? You know, being a father of a young guy, and you know, having to make sure he was home at particular mm-hmm. times, and mm-hmm. trying to find babysitters, if mm-hmm. that or sitters or someone that. You know, like some people, you know, just give up the dating scene altogether.
Right. I'm glad you asked that. I didn't date for almost 2 years after.
Okay.
And I remember there were things that there were events I was invited to. I wouldn't go. I remember my brother telling me once, probably close to almost the 2 year mark, he said, look, you got to try to live your life now. And, you know, this is a new chapter. And if it's okay with you, he's like, I'm not pushing you. You know, you're going to have to just try to get back into the swing and see what's out there. He says, because if you stay home all the time, you know, it does nobody any good. Because then he said, eventually you're going to get depressed, but in a different kind of way. And he said, let's be honest. He said, sometimes Your son, he's probably tired of you anyway, which was kind of funny because I'm pretty strict, you know.
Yeah.
So I waited till almost about 2 years, and I guess initially I didn't introduce him to the first woman I dated at all for almost, I think I must have been involved with her for almost 6 months. And then
mm-hmm.
when I finally did introduce him, he was at my mother's for the weekend, which I had planned. I think he went over on a Friday, and then I brought her to my mother's house. And my son was there with his cousins playing like he usually does with his action figures and everything. And I remember, you know, everybody else knew who she was, but my son never met her. And
wow.
I introduced him. I said, Vincent, this is so-and-so. She's like, hi, Vincent, blah, blah, blah. And she said, "How are you?" He says, "I'm good, I'm fine." But that's always his style. He's good, he's fine. He doesn't judge, he doesn't make a fuss. Mm-hmm. And that's how I had to do it. But there were times, once it got past that stage, that I had to sometimes scrap plans that I had because maybe to discipline him for something he wasn't doing in school. And it caused a little rough times. I remember one of my exes, because, you know, she was a little frustrated and wasn't really getting on my case, but she's like, "You know, we're supposed to do this, but you got to stay with him." My hair started standing on end, and I said, "Look, this is my son, and I have to do
this."
That's
right.
Because I said, if I go back on this and I let him go to his cousins and play, then he won't be punished.
Mm.
And I have to mean what I say.
Right. Now, in today's society, you know, we read on the news all the time about young guys walking around with guns or being involved with gangs. Did you have to deal with any type of harassment with young people trying to, you know, recruit your son?
Not at all. The only problem was really for him was once he went to high school. Down here in Tribeca, as you know, it's a different kind of vibe. And for people that are listening that don't know, the vibe is mostly white.
Okay.
So most of Vincent's friends here in Lower Manhattan were white kids, and it's a whole different thing. I mean, kids are going to be kids, so, you know, all kids get into trouble. But it was a different kind of trouble down here. But once he went to high school, which was A. Philip Randolph up in Harlem by City College, then you have a different element, and I'm going to use that word. I know the media uses it too, but I'm going to use it. And some of those kids, they were out there. Okay.
Listen, Vincent, hold that thought. We seem to have another caller in the queue. Hi, welcome to blogtalkradio.com/hearnoevil.
Hello.
Hello. Hi,
how are
you?
David
sounds
K. Farrell.
Like,
D. Brad.
It sounds like the Brad.
D. Brad.
D. Brad, how
Brad,
are
David
you?
David K. Farrell, to be exact. Or David
Bradley.
Oh, I
love it. This is the one and only David K. Farrell, writer, producer, former producer at BET.
Okay.
And he is our special guest tonight because he is promoting his new book, BET, D. Brad and Me, A Conversation with David K. Farrell. And it's also available at lulu.com. and Amazon.com, Kindle Books. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, thank you. How's everything going?
Okay, we were having a conversation with the
caller.
Who's
we?
Well, the audience. There's a bunch of people online that are having a conversation about good men and raising. And Vincent Cook just happens to be one of the
good
great,
man?
Yes, sir.
One
yes,
of the
sir.
Great, one of the great men that are raising, that raised a boy, a child by himself and successfully. And he was just talking about, you know, the neighborhood and how he raised him old school and how his dating life was a little affected, but it worked out well for him. And we seem to have another caller calling in. Hello? Hello? Okay, I guess they don't want to speak.
No.
Listen, guys, we have to take a small break, but we'll be right back in less than a minute.
Okay.
Hold tight.
Oh,
Welcome back to another segment of Hear No Evil here on blogtalkradio.com. I'm your host, Darlene Lewis. You can call us now to meet me, former producer David J. Farrell. Call us now at 347-989-0761. Hello?
Yeah, I hear a lot of...
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I just hear a lot of music or something in the background.
Right. Okay, so Vincent was talking about a good man.
Yeah, I was telling you about the high school aspect because you had asked me how did things go. I was telling you, like, when I was telling with the high school, that was a challenge because he wasn't asked to join any gang that I know about, but the kids, the older kids that some of them had associated themselves with him and vice versa, they had issues, their parents had issues, and I wasn't trying to hear it, so that caused a little rift also.
Okay. Now listen, David.
I still have a lot of something going on in the background.
I think I have a caller that's playing music in the background. Caller, if you are on the air with us, please turn your music down. Caller, are you there? Okay, we're going to hang up on that caller.
Good idea.
That's how we do. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Yes. David, let's talk about your book, Stop Cooning.
Title.
D-Brad and Me. Let's speak on that. First of all, what made you decide to write the book?
Because I felt like it.
Okay.
It wasn't that big a deal. Well, BET, D-Brad and Me, the title is A Conversation with David K. Farrell. I just speak about my time with this station. Well, actually, I speak about how I even got into the entertainment industry and interning for MTV and VH1 and how when I was in college in 1997 and 98, they used to, the producers of TRL and MTV Jams used to sit around every day at 4 o'clock and watch Rap City. And I asked them one day why they did watch BET, because at the time I didn't even watch BET except for maybe Video Soul. And I didn't even really like Rap City. I liked MTV Raps better. And they told me that that's how MTV gets its rotation as far as hip-hop videos and rappers. And they see, you know, which rap artists that they possibly could, you know, turn into a mainstream star. And this was their exact word. And they said, so we figured that if we watch Rap City and we see a rap artist playing a lot on BET, that the black people must like this artist. So, you know, I never thought much about it. Yeah, I never thought much about it because at the time I wasn't thinking about going to BET. It just, you know, when I did get hired at, you know, at BET, over the phone no less, I never even went in for an interview. But I think they saw MTV and VH1, you know, how, you know, the white man always does it better. So I think that was what they saw. Like, why, who's MTV and VH1? We can use them. And so they hired me. And then I went in BET the next year with that knowledge. And I tried to tell people in the station, but nobody would listen to me. That, you know, like, MTV's watching what they're doing, but they're all kind of like, whatever. Like, because they're so in awe. They used to be so in awe of what MTV was doing because MTV had all this money, and I used to try to tell them, like, nah, man, hey, watch what we're doing. So they didn't want to hear that. And I created the show, the yearly special, Spring Bling. Not that it's anything to brag about because it's all TNA, which I ain't mad at all. Just that, you know, I wish they would have allowed that show to mature. I was a 24-year-old horny kid with money in his pocket sitting in Uncle Luke's house from Two Live Crew, so you know what that was about.
Mm-hmm.
If you're familiar with Two Live Crew at all, you know what that was about. But I didn't expect it to be the same thing every year, but that's what propelled me into the upper echelons of BET as far as having to deal with situations that I dealt with that I write about in the book, is because I went from being a spoke in the wheel, which is really what those in charge of this society look at the average Joe as a spoke in the wheel. A useless eater, someone who doesn't know who they are and why they're here. They just make, you know, they make the system run. So you go, you know, and because that show Spring Bling brought in revenue, whether it was $1 or $2 million, it didn't matter. I earned money for the station outside of the norm, so I became an asset to Black Entertainment Television. So at that point is when, you know, you started allowing me to do things that people that are production assistants, the low man on the totem pole, normally couldn't do. on top of the fact that having created that show, there were artists like Eve that I visually pushed and helped forge this image that we see of her. You know, to Trina, I did the same thing with her. She didn't know it. Eve knew what I was doing, but Trina didn't know, because it was through this other rapper named Trick Daddy who would introduce me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Rockefeller artists not named Jay-Z and Kanye West, you know, because I'm a Philly cat. I grew up in South Jersey, so a lot of those Philly artists, that was me from 1998 to about 2002.
Freeway and...
Yeah, Freeway, Beanie Siegel. Yeah. Beanie Siegel, I put him on the same... I introduced him the same show I introduced Eve, because we were in Philly, and, you know, all the other Philly, a lot of the other Philly rappers affiliated with Rockefeller Records, and, you know, I have visually helped Outkast as far as supporting them, and a lot of people, you know, kind of would look at me funny with that, but what I would tell them is in 1997, when I was in college, I George W. Bushed everybody and took over as president of the second highest funded student organization on campus, and because I worked in the vice president of academic affairs office. And I just kind of finagled my way into the presidency. And in 97, I brought Outkast to Newark, New Jersey. This was when New York wasn't playing anybody outside of New York. So that's how, you know, people look at me funny with Outkast. I'm like, nah. And that's proved my point. In 97, I brought him up here when nobody was to him in, you know, the New York area. But so I went on and I did a lot of that, went into a situation, found myself after doing all of that. My president, the current president, used to always tell me to look at the bigger picture. Things of that nature. I didn't really get it. I thought the bigger picture was black people, because I used to play a lot of the videos. This thing, make a long story short, you watch a video show, this thing called a show mix down, where you have to sit in the control room and marry whatever you shot on the street with the videos, and then sit for 2 minutes during black, that actual commercial. They call Q-tone, but during the commercial time that airs. And because I was a low guy on the totem pole, no matter how great or how much success I had, I still had to go and do the mixes, which was very boring. So I would say from 1999 till about 2001, 65% of the videos that people watched on Rap City, the basement, was what I wanted to see. It just so happened that I was in touch with the, you know, the regular folks. And it wasn't like we were influenced by anybody. We were in D.C. And during that time, especially, D.C. was heavily go-go influenced. There are no record labels in D.C. to come and try to, you know, sway us. So it was just us doing what we were doing and doing, you know, the best that we could do as hip-hop fans. And, you know, there's a lot of artists out here that this Rap City, the basement staff, built the foundation for. And it just so happened I happen to be more of a franchise player, because I'm nice. I'm nice with mine, so it's all good.
So now the 106 and Paul thing.
Yeah, maybe now, who knows? I don't even care. I don't watch it. But I know for a fact when it first started out, when I was there, there wasn't nobody counting them damn votes. I know that for a fact. And there's nobody counting the votes, really, because – the playlist is compromised of videos that the record label has decided that should play at a certain time, and the program director.
So it's like a payola type thing going on over there, like, right?
Yeah. It's a present. That's the thing that, like, a lot of people that are supposedly conscious immediately. It's funny. I sell most of my books with people that are supposedly not of the conscious variety, because conscious people think they know everything, and the person says, "If I don't watch BET, I'm like, you don't get it." So I don't even spend my time explaining to the conscious community, because they know it all. Or if you don't put it in particular words that sounds like something their favorite lecturer would say, they don't get it. But the reality of it is that there really is just this one guy, and that's the current president. So you look at what's been going on as far as black culture the past 10 years, it's the dude who's the president up there. He's done it, because he's the one that has the power to say yes or no, and I know that for a fact. There's not a whole committee. Like when Rap City was out, you know, which is basically what everybody's living off of now, the hip-hop thing that we was doing. When that was out, we all decided, but he had the ultimate, you all right, mama? Hey, go back downstairs, because I don't like the fact that you just stuffed up like this. So he decided that, dang, your door is on. Anyway, my fault, I have my daughter. He decided that, you know, what videos are going to play, what videos are not going to play, yada, 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 so forth and so on. And most people don't understand that. They keep thinking it's this, a conglomerate of people. It's not. It's one or two or three people. I know for a fact.
Wait. You're telling me that one person decided. So if somebody wanted to put females, because I noticed, like, for about five to ten up until now, all you saw was booty shaking, women looking like strippers, and dudes just drinking. I mean, that's all you ever saw. It was like a whole bunch of partying and women just looking like whores. And I just cannot believe that you're telling me that that one person, that no other people could, like, put their two cents in and say, listen,
oh, you
don't
can put your two
on
cents
the radio?
In.
I mean,
you
on,
can put your
on
two
television?
Cents in. No, you could, like, for me, that this, and you could put your two cents in. For me, the scenario where I was different from a lot of the other cats is I couldn't go in his office and argue him down about something. I'd done it before, but that was because he knew who I was and what I was about. So, you know, and he knew the franchise. You know what I'm saying? It's different. The franchise player on the team can get away with a little bit more than, you know, the role player can. You understand what I'm saying? And that's who I was at that station. It still am to this day. So that's why I can talk this talk and not be worried about what someone's going to do or my supposed career being over. You understand what I'm saying? So
now, I noticed
can,
that I've read something, and where you was talking about there was a 25th Silver Anniversary Black Tie Gala weekend.
Yeah, nigga.
That sounds a little crazy.
You didn't even hear the whole thing, really. There was a lot that went on. Yeah, I mean, that was a joint that was a weekend that Bob Johnson, if let it be known to anybody to know that he was boning Deborah Lee. That was just the weekend where Stephen Hill, well, I don't like saying this dude's name, he's such a lame, I don't even want to say his name, but the current president, yeah, they did a skit with all the VPs, like Reginald Hudlin, he was there, he shot, you know, because the running in-house joke with BET was always, we never have no money. So they decided to make fun of themselves, and, you know, you had one, the news executive was 125th Street selling bean pies, and Reginald Hudlin at the time was the executive in L.A., him and his assistant were robbing a bank. It was funny. Like, it was really funny stuff, and it was cool because, you know, once we got to New York, in D.C., the executives would show, you know, themselves as decent people. But once we got to New York and the new guy, the current president, took over, everybody act like, you know, they were just – it really became very corporate and very un-black. You know, everything became the bottom line. And when it was in D.C., they did care about – what it looked like and the effect it had. They just didn't have a lot of production experience because only Discovery Channel, I think, is down there. So it's not like a media mecca in D.C. Whereas it got to New York, it just say became like as if we was a white station and no one cared about the content other than how much props it gets you from other media outlets and how much money it's bringing in. So, you know, they backed the 25th anniversary. It was a funny joint. And then the current president came out with Daisy Duke short song. I mean, you know, this, what they filmed, yeah, they was in a strip club, and he came on a stripper pole and had Daisy Duke shorts on and his shirt tied up to his belly and high heel stilettos. And it was funny until everybody in New York realized, wait a minute, hold on a second. So to me, it was hilarious. I sat there, I looked around at everybody else. Like, I didn't laugh at it in the beginning, but it was funny to me on the inside. And, you know,
did you
I looked
film
at
it?
Everybody else. No, I didn't film it. For what? I mean, if you
did anybody film
know.
That?
They got it on film. It doesn't matter. You don't need to film. Trust me when I tell you. You don't need to film. If you ever met this guy, it's very believable. And then a comedy for me of that story was later on, I was laughing about it in front of another executive. And I'm so mad I put his name in the book now that I think about it because I like the dude. But, you know, whatever. I had to throw him under the bus to make my point. But anyway, he told me that, you know, originally he was like this, and I was like, yo, and the fact this dude had on stilettos is what killed me. And he said he did. Funny part is he said he acknowledged that it was everyone else's idea for him to do that, but he said it as a joke, but that the current president was like, you know what, I could do that. And he was like, but the stilettos was his idea. He was like, he told them he wears a size 13, and they was like, yeah, whatever, until they went to buy him. And they realized, and they found a size 13, and he said they gave him a box of stilettos. He slid them bad boys on like he knew what he was doing. But the vice president, I mean, that current president has a foot fetish. He has a woman's shoe fetish. So, you know, this is a guy that you know, brought in B2K and told everybody in BET that they were going to be the next big thing. And if
you know his history,
he's, you know, especially reading, but they got to get the book to read my running with the dude. He's a sexual deviant. So
is this the same guy who was allegedly accused of molesting Razzby?
Nah, that's the kid named Chris Stokes. But where it
all ties in is
because if you have the president of BET that I tell to his face he's a sexual deviant and dare him to tell me that he's not, I dare him to tell me in that limo he wasn't getting down how he was trying. Now, he wasn't trying to get down how he was trying to get down. And then I know about six other people that he's done it to as well. So I'm like, if the guy who brings this group BTK in says that they're going to be yada, 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 and he's a sexual deviant, if Raz B comes out and says I was molested by Chris Stokes and that current president were cool with each other, well, Apple don't fall too far from the tree. I believe it happened. You know, like I told Raz, I said it before, Raz B just need to take off some whack, corny shades and maybe people would take them seriously. Like, man, like, take the whack shades off and come out and say, listen, you know, he got, you know, he has these crazy looking outfit, Raz B shades. But it happens, it goes down. And it's funny because I always used to wonder how Marcus Houston stayed so relevant. I used to be like, wow, like immature, black group. But this kid seemed to stay. Well, now I understand. Because what people don't realize about Hollywood, that whole scene, is they was in to molesting little boys from back in silent films. James Dean, one of their heartthrobs, everybody in the circle knew he was gay. Rock Hudson, everybody did. He was portrayed as like the hunk of all hunks. That's how you think he got AIDS. Everybody knew Rock Hudson used to like to have sex with little boys. Everybody knew Walt Disney himself used to like to have sex with little boys. You try to marry a little boy. So that's that whole Hollywood scene. It is what it is. So now, once I hear Raz B, I'm like, oh, no wonder Marcus Houston stayed relevant for so long, because I knew it wasn't his talent.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I believe Raz B. I believe him. You know, and it's funny. I took it out of the book, but, you know, there's another member of B2K one time. I was in a Janet Jackson party. My man was eyeballing me like I was fresh meat. So all that going back in my head, I'm like, nah, Raz B not lying. Because wouldn't no grown man say nothing like that just to get no money? You ain't getting no women off of saying that you had sex with another man. Ain't no
so now,
to
are
that
you
sorry,
getting
boy.
Any flack from most of the stuff that you've written in your book?
No. Well, first of all, because I tell it from a comedic perspective. So most people come back and laugh. Second of all, I've had rappers come to 125th Street to buy that book. They just scared because they believe I'm trying to be nice as I speak. Okay. You know what I'm saying? I don't know the radio show, so I'm doing my best not to curse and make fun of a certain ethnic group of people. But they believe in them contracts. So they feel, you know, and it's not even so much the contract, it's that way of life. That's what a lot of people, the average lame gets misconstrued when people talk about being killed because you're going against the Illuminati, which, first of all, real quick to go back, everybody's coming to this Illuminati thing. That's some punk behind nonsense. Because the Illuminati, any knowledge they got all came from black people. So what are you scared of? It's your knowledge. They just took it and flipped it on you. And told, you know, so that's why I tell black people, like, stop talking stupid. The Illuminati don't even exist because all of this is over anyway. If you can't tell that America has fallen, something's wrong with you. But that's what most, and then nowadays you got black folks chasing money like it's going out of style, which it is. So what happened, you dig what I'm saying? So people are scared of losing this way of life. So, you know, that's what kills them. You know, if you really put it on a mundane level, the average person don't even want their neighbors looking at them negatively. We, if our kids act up in the neighborhood, we embarrassed because our neighbors are looking at us funny. Well, now you put that on a larger level. So I understand how it gets to be that way. You dig what I'm saying? And I just happen to come, and I always make it a point. That's why I don't bash the rappers. I come from a home that I had a father who taught me how to be a man. I cannot tell you if I came from a single home and watched my mama struggle her whole life to put food on the table, that I would be having this conversation with you. Because if I had done anything in that limbo, the only person I would have known was the president, and anyone else he would have told did the same thing I did. So what they really going to say?
Okay, now you're talking about a limo.
Yeah. I had a limo ride, but they got to get the book for that. It's on Lulu.com.
Okay, I see you. So you're telling me that you're revealing stuff about the president also in your book? Okay, so this is now.
Yeah. It's the most comical story in the world. I tell it.
But is it true?
Huh? Say it again? Is it true? Man, I ain't getting no props from telling that story. I ain't got one extra woman that says, you know, that story about you in the limo with the president was sexy. If anything.
Okay, but let me tell you something. Now, you're telling me that, okay, first of all, I'm going to order that book tonight, okay, because I need to know exactly.
I ain't
going to
tell
y'all
the whole book.
Huh?
I mean, I have a lecture called Confessions of a BET Producer that's actually on YouTube that a lot of this, I spoke about all of this. And the joint is just that. I spoke about it, and I was like, you know what, let me just write it, because everybody kept bugging me. Said, oh, you should write it. And I said, all right, I'll write it. You know. And I thought it was funny. I thought it was funny because, you know, to me, I understand the government and I understand leaders, but I don't understand the fear that the common man has. Like, so as a child, I used to look and be like, what y'all so scared of? Like, if I was born, you know, if I was alive with my temperamentality, if I was alive during the 60s, 50s, 60s era, I would have been one of them black kids that, like, oh, yeah, the FBI ran up and killed him when he was only 21. But I know we're in a different time. It ain't about physicality. That's why I keep telling people, like, all this, that revolution, that I know what they meant when they said it's not going to be televised. The only revolution you can have is within. So now if I know what your leaders know, but I know that I come from one of the oldest lineages of blacks on this goddamn planet, what you going to do to me?
I have another caller calling in. Hello, welcome to Hear No Evil. Hello, caller.
Hi, are you speaking to me?
Yes, I am.
Well, yes.
Who's this?
Hi. Wonderful to meet you all.
Well, all
okay,
right.
Okay. We're on the phone with David K. Farrell, author and former producer of BET. He's giving us some knowledge. Meet him. His book is available at LULU.com and at Amazon.com. Kindle is called BET, D. Brad, and Me. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. We're also going to be talking about, and I want to ask him, because we were talking in Lean, Vincent, and Vincent, I hope you're still there, and Dow. We were talking about good men, and David, I know this is not a question that you like to answer, but in your opinion,
answer that too, by the way.
David.
I'm just chomping at the
demonstratively.
Bit.
I want to let me hear what he got to say. I don't date men. I don't know what makes a good man. I know what makes a good woman in my book.
I know, but I said, what is? Are you a good man?
Are you speaking with me? I'm Richard, by the way. That way we have a handle. Yeah, the thing of it is that first of all, most women don't know good men. And the fact that women have so much power, a lot of it is government supported, they are not required to behave in a normative way. For example, I've identified five superficialities of women that tend to block them from the love of a man that they say they want. And they're using things such as height, age, the guy's got to be cute. The women, are entitled. That means they want the man to come out of his pocket for them before he even knows them. And I want to debunk this crazy myth that we have about he who finds a wife finds a good thing. Now, what is happening is a lot of women and some men who are not aware of what's going on are allowing women to hijack that particular statement out of the Bible to benefit women who are not a wife to this particular man and who will not be a wife. And, of course, the last superficiality is that he's too nice. A lot of women say they want men who are chivalrous, and a lot of men are chivalrous. But women aren't choosing those men. They're saying such things as, I won't date him because he's too nice. So what we've got to do is, you know, a relationship is really built upon communication, effective communication. And most women are not effectively communicating. Now, they are complaining, true enough, but they're not effectively communicating. Now, I wrote the 7 principles to love, sex, and dating, and there's 7 results. And my first 2 principles are palpable. What I say to women who want to be in relationships with men, because we can't read your mind as much as we would like to. I say to women, initiate a conversation with men. Hi, how are you? My name is such and such. Any man will like that who values himself. And if he doesn't like it, that's her answer that he either has low self-esteem or he's not worth dealing with. And number 2 is that women should pay on first dates. Now, if she can't pay to go to some expensive restaurant, that's fine. A man wants to be with you, so pay to take him to distinguish yourself from other women. Pay to take him to where you can afford. And oftentimes, again, it doesn't have to be expensive. You could just take a man out to get coffee. But women are not communicating with men effective enough to even start a healthy relationship.
Wait, can I say something, please? I think your voice sounds kind of familiar. I might have heard you on one of the other Blog Talk programs. But regarding the paying, who's going to pay for what, I maintain and I still maintain if the guy initiates the date, not the other way around, the man should pay. End of discussion.
Well, men and women should initiate equally. Look, what I'm trying to do, first of all, the system is damn broken. And people who do not understand the problem, of course, cannot appreciate an intelligent offer of a solution to the problem.
Sir, can I just interrupt you for a minute? What's your name again?
Richard.
Richard. And what's your last name, sir?
I don't think it's necessary to have my surname.
Well, you said you wrote a book, so I want to find out about this book.
Oh, actually, it's no, I said I'm the author. It's an article that talks about how men and women should date and effectively communicate. And what I'm doing is saying that at least 50% of the relationship equation is not participating in most cases, and that's the woman. She is not participating. She's sitting back waiting for the man to do everything in terms of initiate the relationship and so on and so forth, but she wants 50% of the control. And so we've got to realign and reestablish our fundamental principles with respect to dating.
Okay, now, sir, Mr. Richard, in what age category?
Just Richard. This is casual.
Richard.
Yeah, I don't have my suit on. I don't have my power suit on right now.
You see why I said let that brother speak first?
Okay. Yeah.
I said,
Richard.
Go on, brother. Go on, man.
Richard, what age category would you consider yourself in? Like, are you under 50 or over 50?
Well, let's just say I'm a very mature man, but that's not the point. What point are you getting at? And I'll be happy to address your
valid. No, the reason why I'm asking is because I have changed my promo, and I have to include all ages. And these are some of the questions that I need to know who's listening to our radio show.
Right. Well, let me address this that way. What I'm establishing are principles. Principles, by definition, are ageless. They apply to a broad spectrum over a broad swath. And what I'm promoting is fairness, given that the relationship, the dating process is broken. So any man will appreciate a woman approaching him and saying hi and initiating a conversation. You can take a poll of the men right there. Now, there are some men that are mangina.
Because a lot of times men, when you try to be the one that initiates the first move, they're a little threatened or intimidated by an aggressive approach.
So, you know, hold on. Richard, can I jump in this here? This is why I didn't want to get involved in it. Because I feel like, and I always said I was never going to say this in public, outward, because I don't feel like the argument, but I am going to say it. And I only date black women, so I can only speak to black women. I've never dated a white woman. I've had one Puerto Rican girlfriend, and that's about it. Once I mess around with a Hawaiian female. I feel as though, and I'm a 36, 7, or 8, one of them. I don't remember which one. But I feel as though until black women accept responsibility for their part in a relationship that falls apart, we're going to have this problem. Because what you're saying, with all due respect, what you're saying in response, every other black woman would say that. And then you can pick up Oprah's magazine, and she'll say it. Pick up Jet. They'll say what you just said. It's almost as if black women have been programmed with automatic response. Men are intimidated. That's not true. You're talking to, obviously, Richard and myself. Now, the other brother, I don't know, but right now you got 2 out of 3 men that are telling you that he gave his perspective. I'm telling you, that ain't true. Now, if you choose, you understand, that's like, and that's why I don't get involved, because it seems as if it's just so much easier for sisters to go, you know what, you ain't no good. There ain't no good black men out here. And I try to give them scientific data that shows you since from however long the beginning, black women have always outnumbered the black male 15-1. So you can take every brother out of jail off the street corner, put him in college, make him look like, walk and talk like Barack Obama.
Let me address that just briefly. First of all, what's oftentimes no good.
Hold on, Richard. I was quiet for a second. Richard, I was quiet for a second, brother. We all the same side. Hold on real quick. So the point that I was just making was that it seems as if, unfortunately, because women seem to kind of watch television a little bit more and read the magazines, this, that, and the other, you're constantly being fed Color Purple, Precious, when they're for colored girls that are constantly telling you this, that, and the other. So therefore, the average brother walk out and trip and drop the trash, he becomes just like the characters that you saw in Precious. And this is what we get all the time. That's why I don't get involved in these discussions, because I almost feel like it's a waste of my time.
Yeah, but you can't avoid these discussions. If you get in a relationship, first of all, we have a 50% divorce rate. So if you don't have these substantive conversations up front, they're going to come back to bite you in the butt. Oftentimes, it is women's decisions about men that are no good. There are plenty of good men. And you have to understand, just because women outnumber men in every racial category.
Not the way blacks have, so when, so you can go back and even check every statistic you want. It's always been that way. The European
this is really not a point to argue, because if the majority of people who could be in relationships were in relationships, that part would not be a major problem. The problem is that you have so many blacks that are, who do want relationships but don't know the process of getting into a healthy relationship or maintaining a healthy relationship. I submit to you that that is the greater problem.
Richard,
because there are a lot of women who are gay, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with being gay. There are a lot of women who are felons. In fact, one of the fastest growing population of prisoners are women, black females. In fact, I think between the ages of 30 and 39, one in every 100 are in prison. But the point we need to do is to be able to come to the table, similar to what we're doing now, and hammer out some effective methods of engaging initially. That's where our major problems
are. Are we to hammer out effective methods, Richard, or are we to hammer out the methods that you think are best? Which one is that?
Well, look, you can put forth yours. I don't think you've stated how one should date and how the initial dating should start. Most people don't deal with that because they are afraid to. I am dealing with it.
I hear you, brother.
And I'm saying
now,
that women have as much
right.
You have
made some very good points, but let me just interject, being that I am a female, that have been, first of all, I also believe that there are good men out here. However, when you say initiate and initiate the conversation, blah, 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 that's really good. But the conversations that most people are having are not relative to anything important. Most people nowadays are so in a rush to become physical that they don't even take time to learn about an individual anymore. It's not like it was when our grandparents or our parents were younger, where there was a courtship and then maybe the guy brought a gift over or a flower. It's different now, and women's standards have dropped, and men's standards of how they should treat women have been lowered, and therefore we have this problem, and then bombarded with the media, and people have been subliminally seduced by what they appear to be, what a woman should be, what she should look like, how she should dress. And if you have enough of these people with this type of mentality absorbing this type of BS, then when they deal with you on a one-on-one basis, they're looking at a caricature from television.
Yeah.
They don't really know how to deal with you as an individual. Because I'm going to tell you, I know a lot of women like myself, intelligent, attractive, independent, that have very great relationships, and you never hear about that. But you always have bombarded in the media that black women cannot find good men or
that
there are no
good
men. And that is not true.
Black women are the prime purveyors of that. No one had a gun to those four women's heads out of Atlanta, making them throw black men under the bus, saying that
they couldn't find men
on their educational and financial standard, which was a bunch of garbage. But going back to the original point that I made, there are plenty of good black men. But women generally, based on their out-of-date behavior in dating, do not know how to access them. And it's very simple. Walk up to a man, hi, how are you, introduce yourself, and then engage in casual conversation. That's the way to do it. I'm a fix-it person. I fix things. I repair things. I'm a troubleshooter of sorts. And therefore, I have looked at the problem. I've seen where the bulk of the problem lies. And I'm offering a solution. I'm tendering a solution. Now, those people who want to
keep... And that is a good idea, but that idea cannot work for every situation, because I'm going to tell you something. Even though we have women that are very, very aggressive and in control, there are still men that want women to stay in a certain place.
Let me say this to you very candidly. Very few, if any, men would resist a woman just walking up to them and being social. That is the fundamental principle of being social. It's just
okay.
Offering
right.
a salutation
there's nothing
and
wrong
engaging
with that, but like I said, dating someone, initially trying to meet someone, and dating someone is two separate things.
Well, this is what I say on it. Okay. I think black people need to have more empathy with one another. Because you know what? As I'm sitting here talking, I realize I jumped into what I'm beginning to see a pointing the finger conversation. Number one, Richard, she's right. There are a lot of women out there who aren't like that, and she's exactly right. The ones that we see are the ones I don't know what your background is, but I come from TV, and I know for a fact that we pinpoint certain people that fit certain agendas. Number two, I swear to God, it's amazing to me how black folks act like this system ain't rigged against them. This system, actually, to be quite honest, and I wrote about it in my book, I think black women get it worse than anybody because black women don't know what to do one way or the other. You understand? From the moment that they come out the womb, they're being told image-wise, and if anybody knows anything about raising a civilization of people, mythology and symbology is key. Everybody knows that. So when they're totally always being mythologically given somebody else that looks nothing like their daddy, their brothers, their uncles, their cousins, and being told this is your savior, then you go to school and you're told this is the principal, this is the teacher, this is the cop, that is Jesus Christ, son of God, so guess the son of God is going to look like his daddy. Then you go to court and it's the judge who looks like so-and-so, and then when you do see someone that looks like you, he's acting like the person that looks the opposite of you. The reality of it is, it seems to be, and I could be wrong, let me know, sis, if I'm wrong, but it seems to be part of the feminine nature is to want stability and comfort. Well, what do you think is going to happen if we're in a system that constantly tells the black woman that I'm not her picture of comfort, but someone else is? She's going to judge us by those standards, and that's why I feel like at some point black people need to have some empathy, man. This ain't no even playing field. I ain't here to hold hands, sing kumbaya, give a damn about Barack Obama being in office. I don't care about Martin Luther King telling somebody I had a dream, because all I remember was his last lecture that he gave. So this whole thing is, this is why I don't like to get involved, because it turns into this. And I almost fell for that for a hot second. Nah, we need to start being more empathetic. Like I said earlier, I'm into showing. I'm not going to talk a black woman set off and tell you that I'm a good black man. I'm going to do what I need to do, what I think is best. And if that works for you, it's fine. If not, I say, hey, sister, go date them white boys. Have fun. You understand what I'm saying? But we at a point, we need to have empathy, man. Everybody keeps acting like this country is all cool because maybe I got a degree, he got some money or a big house, and we just kind of pin our eyes closed to what's really going on unless somebody really comes up right in your face and screams racism. Then we want to run and play the race card. So we can sit here all day. That dating plan is that right and exact. Except the problem is you got to start before the womb, brother. This is genetic engineering. This happens in the womb. When my daughter was in her mama's womb, whatever her mama watched for them 30-some-odd years, it stayed in her genetic makeup and back in her genetic makeup. So my daughter was born with certain things. It took her having to have parents that were conscious of what we were doing to help create that little body so that soul could come down here, that refined soul could come down. It starts before all of that. That's why I don't like getting into it, because if we ain't going, man, listen, we look at everybody else and oh, we the only ones. This man, the white boy giving us some stats. We don't even know enough black people to say 50%, 70% of black people ain't married or having women out of wedlock. Because according to the white boy stats, 92% of the new cases of HIV and AIDS in NYC is black women. Well, I don't know no black woman that got HIV.
So we shouldn't just remain ignorant.
So what I'm saying is you can't go by what the stats are. He don't like you. You're in his kingdom. He's always going to tell you something foul about yourself. So what I say to black people, men and women, let's deal with each other on a regular basis.
Do you suggest that we get – see, this is a problem we run into simply because of the people
who often don't know how to arrive
at solutions.
What did I just say? Stop trying to insult me and
Look, I don't even know you. I don't care to insult you. Let me just make this point, and then I'll listen to you guys.
An article, that's cool, but if you're not going to listen, we can't build. If you're not going to respect her opinion, the other brother, or my opinion, then...
Look, you're just being a bitch.
Oh, this is comic. I love it. Anyway, like I said, man, I gave that brother
I had to get rid of him because once he starts cursing on my show... we have another caller calling in. Welcome
Can I say
something
real
radio
quick,
Dudley?
That got to show you that brother
Welcome.
Had no point to make.
Hello, one second, David. Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Yes, hi. Welcome to Hear No Evil.
Well, this is a fun show. This is good to hear your show.
Who am I speaking with?
Raheem. Cosmic
hello?
Joy.
Lord, what up, Raheem?
Yeah, what's up, peace and blessings, man. You guys are having
David,
a great time,
I can't
man.
I hold this.
Yeah, it's Raheem from Brooklyn.
Raheem the rapper?
No, the hip-hop pioneer, Radio Raheem.
Oh, Radio Raheem. Hi, Radio Raheem. How are you?
I'm,
wow. Vincent, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah,
I got to break out.
Vincent, I am so shocked that you're watching.
Yo, that is comedy. That is funny. I love it.
I gave
it.
Up trying to
it.
Talk because I can't get a word in edgewise. So I said, you know what? Let me just be quiet.
Yeah, because thank you for calling in Radio Raheem. Listen, we were
love.
Just, we were
I got
to
step off.
To have a,
keep it up, Darlene Lewis.
Oh, thank you. No problem.
All
we
the blessings. Okay.
To...
I got to step off. I'm sorry.
Okay,
and all
well,
the other callers
have
online.
A thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm
get
sorry.
That
someone...
the book now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Get the book. Okay. Listen, we get all types of calling in, David, and I'm so glad you wore him out. But
you don't
he
like
seemed like
I
he had
that.
A personal agenda to get his point across, and we weren't allowing it.
Can I say something on that?
Please, Ryan. Mm-hmm.
This is Vince, okay?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Vince.
That guy, Richard, that got tossed off, he's definitely a guy that I heard on another blog show that his sister runs probably back in the summer, and he was running with the same agenda. He didn't get booted off that show, but it got to the point where it was a little obnoxious because he has a habit of, yeah, I know you want to get your point because you did your quote studies, but he paints too many with the same brush.
Mm.
And this notion that this is New York City 2010. Any man that lives here in New York City knows that there's a big reason why a lot of women, black women and Latino women, will not just arbitrarily go up to a guy, hello, how are you? Because a lot of guys on the other side of the coin don't know how to act. Let's keep it real.
Exactly.
Right? So this Disney World thing about, you know, the women need to step up. Yeah, we got a whole lot of problems between the two of us. But what he was saying was totally insane. I'm sitting here and I'm just like going crazy.
I got tired of him, man. I tried to give him his platform, but after a while, I'm like, yo, man, I don't want to hear this no more, man.
Man.
I don't want to point fingers at women no more, man. I have my
right.
personal mm-hmm. issues, but I don't want to. Like, right, honestly, right now, I'm going through a separation from my family. So if
okay.
anybody should be angry at women, it should be me. But I'm like, nah, I accept my part of, you know, whatever happens. But the bottom line is I'm tired of hating black. Well, I never did, but I'm tired of being around dudes that hate black women. Dog, I'm
right.
not. If you can't tell me, and you know why? Because these same men, like that dude Richard, would never talk about the system. He would never talk about the government that way. But you talk about your own women that way? Nah, B,
right.
I ain't
mm-hmm.
trying to hear that.
Right, right.
You know, I ain't trying
Ooh.
To hear that. So, you know, that's funny, though. I love it. I can do that to people. I can pull it right out of them. You ain't saying nothing. Then he get mad and call me your name. Thank you. Get you out of here. I don't know how to talk trash over the phone and on the internet. Like, I don't even know how to do that. I've never gotten to argument over the phone. Like, what do you say to someone on the phone? Like, we're not face to face.
Listen,
so, you know,
but the funny part is that, you know, I listen because I like to give people an opportunity to get their point across. But the show is called Hear No Evil, and I can't have a lot of evil. I can't. You know,
I wasn't
going to
curse back at him,
but
I thought it was funny.
As long as there's a hang-up button, you know, and like I said, everybody has the right to get their 5 minutes of fame. But come on, he didn't even want else, no one else to talk.
Yeah,
let me tell you something. You knew that, and I'm sitting here, and I was waiting, Charlene, for to you. Not Charlene. I'm sorry, I got your wrong name.
Darlene.
Here. Yeah, Darlene. I was waiting for you to step in here because I was sitting there. I said, if I'm sitting on this panel, there were two things that he didn't give, and I would have cut him off right there. First of all, we all grown, and you, a
his
man.
His last name.
That even before that, he couldn't tell you how old he was. Well, let me just say, I'm like, you know, please, Negro, please. We all grown, okay? You can say how old you are. It's not even so. I'm 53. People don't think so, but I am. And then the other thing, he wrote a book, but then when you ask him what's his last name, well, I wrote an article.
Why? Right, don't you want to promote it, baby? That's what I'm
oh, God, I can't
yeah,
take
but,
it.
But the bottom line
is
like
comedy.
I said, don't let, you know, I get all, listen, you have no idea how many people are on hold and are calling in and who just left there because, you know, it is what it is. The bottom line is that we're on for the next 55 minutes.
Right.
I want to talk more about the process of you leaving BET, David, and like how you transitioned into being an author.
Well, I left BET. Really, I, it was always in my plan. I was going, man, I just broke your sofa. No, I was sitting with my brothers. I was sitting on something. It's all good. I left BET originally. My original plan was to leave because I wanted to be an actor. So I went and joined the Negro Ensemble Company, stayed there for a year, and went to a lot of auditions, did a lot of theater. And at the same time, I wrote a couple screenplays, a couple of them that, got some interest. A couple got interest in Hollywood. I had an actor come from L.A. Like, hey, I was at a party, heard about your film. And, Megan Good, I had a project that she was, interested in that I was talking to her and her people about. They asked me to come back to produce the show, and then I came back, and specifically because Reginald Hudlin was there. And anyone that knows me knows that, when it comes to film and TV, Robert Townsend, Reginald Warrington Hudlin, and Kenan Ivory Wayans were, like, my inspiration. Like, I would be more, all my stuff would be more comedic in the sense of how I wrote it. And especially Reginald and Warrington Hudlin, I mean, they did a house party, which to me was like, that was the first time I ever saw somebody capture what I saw as my youth on screen. So I always idolized them. And then when I saw he was there at BET, I was like, oh, I got to get back in. And lo and behold, they wanted me to come back anyway. And the second time I left in 2007 was one morning I had so much rage inside of me that I woke up and punched a hole through my wall. And I'm not an angry type of dude like that stores anger. And I knew what it was. I mean, I'm working on a show at a black college campus, and I'm getting executives calling me saying, hey, D. Brad, we love what you're doing, but let's put some of those light-skinned girls with the baby hair in the front. Them sisters, they're a little too heavy set, so let's weed them out, put the little model thin girls in. And I'm like, who I am. Everybody in BET knew who D. Brad was, like how he was on his blackness. So for you to ask me that, really, and of course I didn't listen, and which they knew, but I guess the fact that they had to still feel the need to try it one last time, but, then I left. At that point, I was like, I can take you sitting with your legs cocked open in the limo hoping I'm going to look. I can live with that. I'm mad enough to live with that. I ain't do nothing anyway, so it don't even matter. But now you're telling me straight in my face, hey, man, we need you to be a jigaboo. We need you to sell out, brother. Nah, not for the money they was paying me. I was making close to six figures, not for what they was paying me. Like, nah, B, I ain't, that was never, I'm from old school. Like, I grew up believing you don't never sell out your own people. That's just me, and I'm going to live with that decision for the rest of my life, and I'm comfortable with it. So that's what I left. But in between all of that, when I be coming back, I forgot to mention a very important part of the book, because I was Dave Chappelle's stand-in on Chappelle's show the first season. I used to do all his rehearsals.
Oh, really?
Dave Chappelle and Charlie Murphy used to always give me advice. Like, Dave's the reason why I can sit down and write a sketch comedy show. He used to always give me advice. And there was things he said to me that didn't make sense at the time. But after he left the show, I said, that's what he was talking about. And that's in the book, too. So I used to do his rehearsals. They used to call them the D. Brad rehearsals because they didn't know I was an actor. And the casting director of his show actually saw me in a play, off-Broadway play, called When a Woman Loves a Man, when it was my first lead. And he really liked me. I played a functioning cocaine addict, probably the greatest role I ever played. So much fun playing a dark character like that. But he liked me, and he would tell Dave about me, and Dave would just never put me on the show. And at the time, being, in my acting grind, I used to be like, oh, man, your Dave is fronting on me. But then now 3-4 years later, I know why, because Dave automatically knew, like, this ain't him. Like, I would have been Ashy Larry, one of them type of cats. And he knew that that was far from who I was going to be, especially, for whatever reasons, either consciousness, talent level, whatever it was. But I do know that he thought highly enough of me because I had people coming. I had a friend who plays professional basketball, and she told me one day she was in L.A., ran into the dude, she talked about you for like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so I've always gotten a lot of love from him when he would perform. He would just get in love, meaning he would give me advice. We didn't hang out. We wasn't friends, wasn't invited to his house. But it was kind of like, you're on the same team as LeBron James, and you practice against him every day. You just don't get in the game because, it's LeBron James. But then when you go off to another team, you take everything you learn practicing against him, LeBron, and you watching him play and him coming off the court telling you, hey, man, I took that jumper because A, B, C, and D. You'll go to another team and be a star. And that's pretty much what I was getting from Dave and stuff from Charlie Murphy from, time to time. He would drop little tidbits and so forth and so on. So I was part of the Emmy-nominated Set Desire team on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. We were nominated for Emmy in 2004, the year after I left Chappelle's show. And so I just did a lot of crew with us. I was part of the stunt unit on Spider-Man 2, worked stunts with stunt unit with Law & Order when they were shooting New York, and Third Watch when that show was still on. So I went off and I just learned a lot because I was hoping, you know, I was thinking I was going to go back to BET and take everything I learned and then bring it to BET. Like, listen, this is what I learned out there because I was one of the few urban producers that actually did both worlds. I was in the hip-hop world as much as I was in the mainstream TV and film world.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came back, they didn't really want that knowledge. That was not what they wanted.
So now the Firestorm takeover, when did that happen?
1999, Bob Johnson, when we moved to New York, about 2000, with Viacom, they'd taken over. That's when
because
that happened. That's when
like
they said
since Viacom took over, it became more coonerish.
Well, yeah, once again, I don't know why black folks don't get it. They don't like you. It's not even that they don't like black people. Let me take that. You know what I learned working crew production? There's a big reason why you see these images of black people on TV. And it's not even necessarily because it's racist. I know I did, somehow I got on Saturday Night Live, and I was doing background work. This is right after the Towers fell, because the skit we had was an Osama bin Laden parody that they came. SNL shoots twice. They shoot once at 11 o'clock, all the skits, and they shoot whatever skits they keep, and again at 11:30. And they said, Tracy Morgan wrote the skit, but they was like, loved it, but guys, you know, 9/11 just happened 3 weeks ago, and this ain't going to fly. So I didn't get on. But what I did do is I ended up in the producer's office, and I used to watch Tracy Morgan play Hustle Man on Martin. So when I was in there talking to one of the producers, I was like, oh, man, Tracy was really funny when he used to play Hustle Man on Martin. And every white producer in that office turned around and said, what? Tracy was on TV before? I said, yeah, he used to be on Martin. Y'all never watched Martin before? He was like, you mean Martin Lawrence that hosted S? I said, yeah. He was like, he had a show? And I said, oh, my God. Do you understand what I'm saying? And then then I was on Cry for the Straight Guy, and I walked, because one of the producers that's black, her husband works at BET. So I walked in, I mean, we're doing set design, and we're doing mansions where we're going to get Ralph Lauren suede curtains to replace the other stuff that they had. Like, we're giving rich people richer stuff. So I go to the black woman, like, yo, I mean, like, this is crazy. Like, why can't we go to some middle-class family? But preferably, can I see some black people? Because, I mean, well, I'm working 7, 8, 9 months, and I don't see not one black family. It's all white people. She gives me the typical African-American response. You know how it is, Ibrahim. It is what it is. So, you know, I'm a production assistant working on the cube trucks and all that. I go to the producers and I bring up the idea like, yo, you know, can we get some, you know, ethnic people? Lo and behold, a week later, I'm unloading the truck. Lowly production assistant. I ain't no producer. I'm on the low, man. Like, we got to get the trucks and load the trucks up. All, like, 3 or 4 of the producers, NBC producers, come up to me and go, hey, D-Brad, guess what? We've got a Haitian family next week. And I turned around and I looked at them. I said, that's cool. You did your job. And they were kind of puzzled. And then I just turned around and did my work because I'm like, well, you know, it's like someone bragging me to take care of your children. All right, man. So you're supposed to. That's how I looked at it. But then it hit me. I was like, you know what? It ain't the fact that these white people are really racist in Hollywood and television film right now. They ain't paying y'all blacks no attention. So the only images they get is from the videos, because when I was in that same office at NBC for Cry for the Straight, I mean at Bravo, the black woman said something about us knowing each other because her husband worked at BET. And so one of the producers said, what's BET? And she was like, Black Entertainment Television. And the other three producers on this Bravo show turned around and said, there's a black TV station? And then the cool, hip, white producer walks in and goes, yeah, that's where they play all the rap videos. So the problem is the only thing that these white people see, white America in mass, in my humble opinion and in my experiences, if people get offended if they want, are probably the most unempathetic in mass group of people I've ever seen. You dig what I'm saying? Meaning if it don't happen to them, they don't get it. And if they don't get it, they throw it away. They turn it back to, oh, whatever. So I realized, like, wow, they just don't pay attention to black people. No wonder I watch cartoons and I still see a black character with a box haircut or him walking down the street with a big box radio or doing very what we call stereotypical. It ain't that. It's just that they're not paying us no mind. So if you got a black producer and they'll look at the black producer like, hey, what's stopping? If that black producer, because there's 100 other people behind her or him waiting for that job in TV and film, which is very cutthroat, 9.9 times out of 10, they're going to say, oh, you know, that's cool, and go about their business. And in their mind, they're going to say, well, at least there's someone black on there. And at least I'm the black person working on the show. You understand? This is what happens in Hollywood and in television and film. So it ain't really that these white people that are doing these shows, like, I don't like you, I'm racist. Nah, they just doing what they know how to do. Like, if I did a film and did it exactly how I wanted to do it, I would probably portray white people as how I see them, to view them through my eyes. And white America might look and say, wow, that's kind of crazy. Like, you think we're savages like that? I'm like, you know, and if ain't nobody white there, the same thing, because he's scared that he's going to lose his job, guess what type of films you're going to get from me? You know what I'm saying? This is what happens in Hollywood and television and film. All the black people don't even realize, all you ever got to do is stand up and go, and without being angry and upset and saying it's racist, be like, yo, we don't wear them type of haircuts anymore. What you doing? Oh, well, I thought, and then you go, you show them. But they scared because, you know, TV and film, you lose your job in a minute. Straight up and down.
But
they'll
in a minute. The problem is that there are people of color that work in these stations that do not reflect the people that they have in the movies.
But they're
so
scared,
what is it? They don't
lose
see them?
Jobs. No, no. Understand. They're scared to lose their jobs.
You see, this is why I walked away from CBS when I got out of college, because I wanted to do my own thing. When I actually went to intern at his network and seen how fake it was, I hated the fact that my major was communication. I'm like, am I crazy? I spent all of these years doing this, and this is what it is?
It's a lot of money.
It's so fake.
A lot of money. Well, like, I'll tell you another thing. For instance, like a lot of these urban gossip sites, like I know for a fact, not Media Takeout, not that one I'm not talking about, there's another one that I know for a fact. There's a couple of
TMZ?
These very popular urban sites, and I ain't going to throw it in because the dude is cool. He cool,
awesome.
And I get it. But I know for a fact the guy who runs it is a conscious brother. I was stunned when I met this dude. I said, hold on, son. That's your site with all that nonsense up there. He's like, man, 99.9% stuff I put up there, percentage stuff I put up down here. I don't even watch or listen to it, man. That's a bunch of effery, man. I don't care about that. And he's playing because his cousin told me that she didn't know. And he's playing Confessions of a BET producer like, yo, I love this dude. And she's like, that's Dave. And that's how we met. And I'm saying, wait a second, homeboy, this is what you put on your site. And I said, oh, okay, I get it. If the money's right, brother making six figures, what you going to do? It ain't his fault that we put our children in front of the television. And if I was really, if I was smart and not intelligent, I would have been smart enough to say, hey, it ain't my fault. But because I'm intelligent, I began to see, like, no, it is my fault because I'm partaking in it. There's no such thing as being blameless because I partook in it. But if I was smart, I would have kept the money because when I left, I ain't really see, you know, black America. They're like, brother, you did what you did your thing. No, no, no. You understand what I'm saying? You know, so it makes it very difficult to really leave because I had to really stand in my square. But if I was a weaker dude, I wouldn't have been able to do what I did. I mean, it's tough going from being single, making six figures, you know, first time I've been out of the country, was on BET, Dime, I can go to L.A., this, that, and the other, you know, so forth and so on. And then all of a sudden you walk away from that. So now you better make sure that you got your finances straight and whatever that, you know, I used to blow $300, $400 a day like it was nothing. Well, now
okay,
I can't
hold
do
that thought. We'll be right back. Hold that thought. Literary Ladies Tour. For more information, go to futurenetworkproductions.com and click on the Literary Ladies for my upcoming book tours. We're back. So, David,
yeah.
Continue.
Yes.
I forgot where I was because my little salesperson had to wipe her nose. So.
You were talking about white people don't care about black people.
Nah, hey, I don't say that because they shouldn't care about y'all. It's a problem. Y'all want everybody to love you. Love yourselves.
Listen, I like that. Love for self.
I'm not worried about it. That's why when people come to me, I've had someone come to me the other day, oh, you hate white people. Like, what? I'm too arrogant to be hating somebody, dog. I ain't thinking about y'all. You can't hate somebody you're not impressed with. So let me clarify that. You cannot hate someone you're not impressed with. So anyone listening, I can be racial without being racist, and I'm just being racial because I'm talking about the difference between ethnicities.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective.
Okay, so now that you left BET, you're on a mission to promote your book. Are you doing any book tours anywhere?
Yeah, I'm about to hit. We're working towards going to at the black colleges. I just have to get a couple things straight because I talked about that whole Boulé situation and dealing with the fraternities, and I kind of felt bad doing that because having gone to college, fraternities and sororities serve a very, very positive function as far as I'm concerned. I saw a lot of kids with no self-esteem get self-esteem by being in a frat sorority, and, you know, and it helps out a lot, and it just, you know, I kind of feel bad I had to do that, but, you know, I said,
yeah, but, you
know,
the history behind it, sometimes you just got to be real. I mean,
yeah,
that doesn't mean
that
the history is going to last because people that got involved, that get involved with sororities and fraternities, they put in their own cultural mannerisms, and it could change, you know. But I understand.
Yeah. I didn't get it when I was in college. I never liked it. Yeah. When I was in college and I'll be confronted to pledge, I'm like, I'm a black man. I don't know about no Greeks. Last I remember, the Greeks learned from me. So what I look like pledge is Greek. When you sat at my feet, that's crazy. That was always crazy. The only one I ever thought about pledging was Alpha. But then, of course, Alpha, there's significance behind all of that. But still, it's like I never understood these black people. Like, yo, dog, you know your history. God, there's enough books, Ivan Van Sertima, Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, whoever, J. Rogers, to tell you that the Greeks served at your feet. And you're going to join an organization based off the same people that learned from you? You're crazy.
I agree with him. I agree.
Crazy.
I mean, but you know what? Is there going to be a change until there's a curriculum of inclusion and until there are schools that are really, really ran from a Afrocentric point of view, then you're going to have these things. I mean, nobody's changing.
I don't think it's that serious, though. I mean, understand how I'm talking.
I do.
I lived that life. I was the president of a college center board at my school. I worked in the vice president of academic affairs office, which means I knew every provost, and me and the president of that college, that university, was well, was my man. You understand? So that's why I'll say I'll disagree with you, say it has to be A, B, C, and D, because it was always respected when it came from me. White people have never. I've been this way my whole life, and I ain't never have a problem from white people. You know what I had a problem with? Black people that were scared and cowards. They were the ones that would come, yo, man, don't start that. But I'm like, well, why they give me everything I want? Because I walked in who I am, and I don't, you know, I'll admit it. Anybody white that has known me, no, you can't come around me talking about no damn Christopher Columbus because I'm going to scoff at you. Ha! You believe that nonsense? You can't come to me telling me about your Thanksgiving because I say, well, that's cool because I can't wait for another team so I can celebrate 9/11 Day. Oh, we got a problem with that? What's the problem? Because that's the same, essentially the same thing you celebrate. So everyone knows that, and I've gotten more than the average jigaboo and coon I see out there selling out. So I'm saying, well, if it works for me, how come the average person? I don't have a problem. Listen, I know I'm in a society. I'm in a school system. I just had to talk with a sister in the bookstore. I said, ain't nothing wrong with your child coming from that school. You sit down for 20 minutes, and what ain't true, it ain't true. Period in the story. Like, we don't need no nothing. Do it. Do it. There's nothing stopping you from raising your child being black-centered. Think black first. Because that'll help you understand religious texts. That'll help you understand the logic. Think black first. You can read that Bible and say, oh, that's what they mean. Because they were black people talking about black people. They didn't know nobody. They didn't, because they was racist. They ain't never seen no white people before when they wrote this stuff. So they write about the, you know, brothers on the corner, this, that, and the other. And I tell people all the time, it could be a whole black world and we would still have these issues. I ain't never said black people were perfect. I'm just saying that all of these texts, all of these sciences were written and come up with by black people. If you want to understand science and astrology, look at it from a black woman's perspective. It had to be a black woman that came up with astrology and science. I don't need to know the moon. I don't need to know no seasons. I don't need to know when the moon, this, that, and the other, because I don't have no periods. I don't have no children. I don't bear no children. So I don't need to know. No, all I need to know how to kill the buffalo, bring it back home. You dig what I'm saying? But we look at it from someone else's perspective. So I want to argue with you over statistics that I got from the U.S. Census or whatever. Well, they're lying. So why am I arguing with you over what he said? People talking about 2012, this calendar, that calendar. Well, if they were Olmecian, like I put in my book. If I know black people, like I kind of think I know black people, the Olmecs are being roundabout. They were like, well, you know, sometime between here and there. Black people don't be on no time, like exactly at 5 o'clock. No, they were just saying, you know, nigga, you know, from here to there, something about to happen. And we hold on to 2012. When Julius and Augustus Caesar added their names to the original sun calendar, which threw the whole calendar off, but we stuck on 2012 because he said it's 2012. He said, you know, put the clocks back so we go by that time. I mean, it's retarded, and I think I get along. My best friend was a German kid, and I was the same way. His family knew they just couldn't come to me with no nonsense. We was cool. So I look at people that give me excuses, and I say, really? Because I've achieved a lot. I've walked away from more than most people who jigaboo, coon, and buck pants even get coming their way. So why? So how can I get it all? How come it's only been black people that harass me? Don't nobody white harass me about nothing. They shut up and move out my way.
Mm-hmm.
You dig what I'm saying? And I worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art before, and I've done all of this. I've seen the lies in their books. That's why I can't nobody come to me with no scholarship and tell me nothing, because the first thing I'm going to say, well, who published that book? Oh, Simon & Schuster, they're lying. Let me take you to the Metropolitan Museum and show you all the lies, because everybody gets all their stuff from the Metropolitan Museum of Art when it comes to geography and history, for the most part, and they're lying, and I can prove it. I worked this store for 2 years. I can walk you around every book. I can walk you to everything ancient from ancient Egypt to show you. See, look, they bleach out the face. I know what... You know, curators do. Dude told me.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they get a lot of these things in and they fix them up. As he's shaving the nose thinner of this wooden statue, he tells me, yeah, you know, we fix it up so that the mainstream public will be more acceptable for the mainstream public. So in my head, I said, oh, yeah, okay, so you bleach the faces of these artifacts from Kemet. So, that, okay, I get it. I understand. You understand what I'm saying? It is what it is. It ain't even that simple, man. This was a war. We black people were taking over. And these are strategies of war. And it ain't, you know, if I take over your house, I'm going to go after your weakest son or child that think that they not getting what the other kids are getting. And that's how I'm going to infiltrate. And then I'm going to make that weak one a general in my army because he's a strength for me, but he's weak. So all these black people that we see in position of power, that's who they are. Those are the people that was, like, on that W.E.B. Du Bois tip, which I wrote in my book because he was adamantly against Marcus Garvey. W.E.B. Du Bois leaving that talent to 10th. And he meant to, there's 10% of black America that can fit in this system and fit very well. And if you ain't part of the 10%, you ain't part of nothing. And that was W.E.B. Du Bois. And that's how he was on now. If I'm wrong, somebody feel free to tell me, but I don't think I am. So it just all depends on the perspective. I have a perspective like, yo, I'm here, I'm a Native American. You know, my family lost what we lost during the Reconstruction era. But since we're in another Reconstruction era, I'm getting my stuff back. Thank you very much. Because that's what we're in right now, Reconstruction.
Yes, we are. So where's your future? What's the future for David? Or what's your plan, your goal?
Well, for right now, I'm just push this book, raise my daughter the best I can. And, you know, I have a couple things on the low that I plan on doing, but it's really nothing to speak about until I do it. But just for probably for the next year, the immediate future, this next year, I'm going to just push this book, and I'm pulling it off the shelves after next year. I'm pulling it off the shelves. I want J.E. Rogers status. I want some J.E. Rogers status. You know, that's what I always jokingly say, like, can't call yourself no black historian if you ain't got no J.E. Rogers sex volume, sex and race volume 1, 2, or 3. I don't want to really hear it, but so much you got to say. But that's just talking trash because there's a couple cats that I just got put on to. I'm like, oh, I should have known about him. So you know how that goes.
Well, I want to thank you, David, for calling in the show. We've come to the last half hour of the show, and I got to throw some music up in there. So
yes.
I want to thank you so much because it's
thank
been
you.
2 days of talking to you and to really get into your brain and to see where you're coming from. And I see you are 100% true to what you stand behind, and I appreciate that.
My truth.
And
my
Vincent,
truth. Not yours.
I want to thank you for holding on this long and being there, listening
problem.
And learning and giving us your 2 cents.
You're welcome. I just found it interesting. I said, okay, so at one time BET was basically a minstrel show. Interesting. As I know somebody on radio once called it. Nah, he said, it ain't black entertainment television. He said, it's beige entertainment TV, and don't get it twisted. I said, I hear you.
Hey, man, listen, you know, I'll be trying to real quick, you know, that Stop Cooning campaign, we starting that this summer. I'm trying to call the Civil War in the black community. We going separate. When I was growing up, we knew the difference between the Uncle Tom's, Jigaboos, the Coons, and regular black folks.
Yep.
That day and age, you can't tell who's who, so I'm trying to start trouble. And people be asking me, what are the characteristics? I'm not giving it to you because I give it to you, the coon is going to flip it. So now
right.
I want people on their own to judge who's cooning. I do want to see family split apart. You a coon. I want to say we need to step sides and stop cooning and get over there with who you running with. Let me do my thing over here. So I'm having fun with it.
Well, good luck to you, brother, and I'm going to get that book because I got to check this out, man.
Oh, yeah, and I think y'all will like it. You know, we try to keep it light and fun, you know, all that good stuff. I thank you so much for, you know, all the support, BET, D, Brad, and me. We all good, baby.
All right.
Thank you, and thank you guys
thank
for calling
you.
In. And until next week, I guess I'll
yes.
see you on the Internet.
Yeah, yes.
Have a
all
good
right,
one.
And when you
one
see,
love.
If you talk to Pooh, tell her I said what's up.
I will.
Okay, now.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Dipping, but not pimping. To the beat, see what we wear. Night and day look hard, yet there. It's all good, we feel good. Hand clapping, chilling in the hood. My boy is nice. Feel the move, it's gravitating. Earth shaking. Make no mistake, and we can't be taken.
Oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh.
woman and everything you own. So love, I've been plainly stating that chances go around. But if you want to know the truth about it, I tell you what's wrong with you. Go see a woman, she ain't even there. Sing with them on your track of time. The more I think about it, I think you're about to lose your mind. Some people call me sick, some say it ain't my day. But if you want to know the truth about it, then tell you what's pulling you. Well,
welcome to Hear No Evil. You're on the air, Carla.
Hi, darling Lou. This is Grandma Funk from the Funk Hut calling in.
Hey, Mama, Mama.
How are you doing?
How are you? Oh, my God.
I just got done throwing down on my veteran free meal from Chili's, and I'm happy.
Well, I have not spoken to you in so long. It is amazing. How are you? How you been?
I'm great. I'm so proud of you. You got the radio show going on and stuff. All my grandbabies have just really blossomed into wonderful, wonderful people, and I'm just so glad I was there to show you some Grandma Funk love.
Oh, I really appreciate it. I've been seeing you blowing up Facebook, you and Koi. And I had to get you to call in because I saw the picture. I never even knew you were in the armed forces. That's
well, you
wonderful.
Know, I've done so many things I done did. I done forgot what I done did until that client come around to show off.
Well, honey, I know you from being one of the greatest publicists and innovators and just creative. You just help so many recording artists, and you do so many good things, and I miss those parties you used to throw here in New York City, and we need you back here, girl. I don't even go out anymore.
Girl, I don't either. I miss my phone cut parties too. I really look forward to those Tuesdays and just cooking for everybody and everybody being treated like VIP. That was like, you know, it was like grandma's house full of children, you know, and it was just
yes,
always such a peaceful, pleasant, loving experience. So
yes,
yeah,
we'll
too,
never have that again. No one will ever be able to bring that vibe back again. No one.
Well, don't say never, because we're working on some things.
Well, you
we
better
be
hurry up and get it here now. Get it here.
You,
well,
know,
you know, I still got a TV show. I have a TV show now also. Yeah, my own, finally. Not working for nobody else, doing my own thing. Celebrity Showcase every Wednesday, Time Warner and RC and Cable, and we stream it on the internet as well.
Oh,
and then
beautiful.
on Thursdays we do this, but you know, I'm doing my book tour, so I'm using the mediums just to promote our Literary Ladies book tour. And we just had a great producer, former producer at BET on, and it got really heated, girl. I mean, we had callers calling in and trying to tell us what a good man is, and it just
well,
got...
Well, you know, only God knows what a good man is, and if he's not following the Lord, then he's missing on the good part.
That's right.
That's all I got to say.
I wish you would have called in early, because we needed another female perspective.
Well, I just got back from Chili's, girl, so I'm on my way to Krispy Kreme to get my donut dessert.
Uh-oh. Well, don't gain too much weight, man, because you know those things are addictive.
I know. I had six of them the other day and had a massive headache.
Did you say six?
Yeah, well, you know you can't eat just one. They just come in and slide right down. By the time you look up, the box is empty. You look in sugar.
So, Eddie, you got anything coming up, anything the listeners need to know about?
Well, you know, I do dance music now, which is sort of ironic coming from hip-hop. So hip-hop has made me so funky that I went to Europe, and my first single I did, I See You, Baby, with Groove Armada, has gone gold, and it's been a hit for the last 12 years, which I'm grateful for. So I write, songwrite, and I MC in clubs and stuff. But, you know, sometimes you can just live life and just do your own thing, and then after a while you start to feel voids in your life, you know?
Yeah.
And I had all the fame, all the fortune, went around the world, saw all the people, and was still not satisfied. So I had to take a year off and just start walking with my Lord, and I am so filled with all those things that I was trying to fill myself up with but couldn't. Now I'm just full, you know, and I'm just so happy and grateful now. So I will be stepping probably back into the arena to do some music again. And like I say never about the phone cut.
Well, listen, whatever you do, I know it's going to be funky. We got to do a
you
song together. You know, I'm still writing. I'm still singing, but I'm just holding off. I've been writing a lot of gospel lately.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, man. So I've been getting worked on. But doing the book thing, when you get to New York, I don't care if you're just here for 2-3 hours. You got to look me up.
Well, that's so funny because I was living in Spain, Ibiza, for 8 years. And then I moved back to New York, and I was like, where are my people? So I moved to Miami, and now I'm in Los Angeles. And it feels good here. It's like God took
you
me
like
all the way
there?
Around the mulberry bush. Oh, I love it. I really, really do.
I'm
surprised
you didn't get into film being out there.
Well, you know what? I did a few things here and there, but I'm not one to be faking it. If I can't just be real and be me, then I find it difficult to be trying to play somebody else. So I'm doing what I do best, and that's keeping grandma funky. So, you know, I move with spirit. So I'm like, okay, God, what's the next round? What's the next adventure? So, like I say never about the phone cut, baby.
Well, I'm waiting for you. I have patience, and I waited this long, and I know when you come back, it's going to be funkier than funk.
Well,
and,
you don't have to come here and bring your cameras with you.
I know. You know, when I get out there, definitely I will look you up. Trust me. I will get to you. And to make sure you say hello to Koi. I see she's still snapping them photos.
You know she is all over Hollyweird.
I know. I see her doing her thing. She's doing what she likes to do.
Most
well,
definitely, God has been gracious to us. And it was
yes.
a pleasure talking to you, girl, and just let the Lord lead you, and you will not go wrong.
Thank you so much. Thank
You're
you.
You're so welcome,
and
girl.
Perfect.
I love you and miss you.
Love you, too.
All right, mama, have a good one.
Okay.
You know it. Hi. I see you, baby.
Okay. Wow, Grandma Funk. There will never be another Grandma Funk. Oh, my God. She was such a great person when I first started out doing public access, getting asked for me and just letting me know about all of the great events and just her parties, oh, her beautiful parties. We would go to eat good food. She would have, like, the old-fashioned candy. We just had a good time. That's when you could go to a club and step on somebody's toe and not worry about getting shot or beat up or stabbed or robbed. Yeah, the funk hut days, man. We got to get that back. But I want to thank you all for joining me once again, and I'd like to thank my guest, writer David Farrell, also known as D. Brad. And please go out and get his book, B.E.T., D. Brad and Me, as he talks about his experience as a former producer at BET and his experience with VH1 and all of the nonsense that went behind him leaving BET. Tune in every Thursday at 6:30 here at blogtalkradio.com/hearnoevil, where we always talk about real topics. And as always, I wish you a lot of love, peace, and make sure you get my books, lulu.com/Darlene Lewis is where all my books are. And follow me on Facebook and tweet me at doll360 at Twitter. Until next week.
Ghetto baby. Little mama, I wanna watch you shake it all night long. City where these women get down, they wanna ball all night. Bodies man tight, like anything goes as long as you treat them right. And I make your body just move in the club, and after the show we just light up a dub. High fives on the bar, the pub, and then give you more than 12 hours of love. We spending paper, son, kissing and kissing on them, as long as they be licking and licking on them. Yo, it's a dirty game, and we ain't playing, hun. So come on inside, you know the outcome. In the NYC and in the limelight when we're out in the sea. It's just my G and me, we're rolling arm in arm. And when I'm on, I'm on, she give me sweaty palms. I give her lucky charms, you know that keeps her happy. She's always on time and never late exactly. We spending paper, son, kissing and kissing on them. As long as they be licking and licking on them. Yo, it's a dirty game and we ain't playing, hun. So come on inside.
I've already answered like too many times before. Now, ladies, if you got a man and he treats you real good, ain't you gonna flex every chance that you get now? Ain't you gonna love him just like you should? Especially when you never thought you would, yeah.
But the wife of George, and we're moving on up.